Welcome to Inside Whitehall with me, James Starkey.
And me, Jonathan Gullis.
Thanks for joining us today. On Inside Whitehall, we try to explain how Whitehall really works. But I think up until now, we've had a pretty huge omission from that, which is that you can't really explain how Whitehall works without talking about the civil service. And so it's an episode we've wanted to do for some time. We really wanted to get a good guest, which is why we're absolutely delighted to get not a good guest, but an amazing guest in someone who led a major department in Whitehall for 6 years. We're delighted to be joined today by Sir David Bell, who led the Department for Education under, I think, 4 Secretaries of State, and also saw the transition of one government into another, which is equally fascinating. Sir David, I think you might not say this yourself, but I would say you're a giant of the world of education. I mean, looking at your backstory, coming all the way from a school teacher to a headmaster to the chief inspector of schools for nearly 4 years, to then being a permanent secretary for 6 years, to then leading two universities, as vice chancellor, Reading and now Sunderland. We're really, really grateful that you could join us, and we're very, very glad that we've got a guest such as yourself to talk about this really big topic that we've missed so far.
I don't really want to interrupt you, James. Keep going with all that flattery. Great to be here.
So, David, we always start with every guest we've had on kind of how they got into where they are. Now, my experience in government was a lot of permanent secretaries tend to come, generally, they might leave and come back from the civil service. So I was curious about how it came about that you entered. Obviously, you were Chief Inspector of Schools, but how you came to be Permanent Secretary, your kind of entry into Whitehall, as it were.
Yes, I mean, you're right, James. I wasn't a career civil servant and never really thought of myself that way. I came into Ofsted and did the Chief Inspector's job for around 4 years. And then there was, I think, a rather unexpected vacancy at the Department for Education, and the then Cabinet Secretary, Sir Gus, now Lord O'Donnell, asked me if I was interested. And to be honest, I'd never thought of it before. So you might call me the accidental as opposed to the accident-prone permanent secretary. So I suppose I ended up that way. But I had a great time, and I never, ever look back with anything other than pleasure at the time I spent in government.
That's quite an unusual entry. I'm curious, when did you know what you were kind of going in for? So you seen enough of it that you knew what you were kind of letting yourself in for, so to speak?
Well, I'd watched Yes Minister, so what else did I need? I suppose I had some understanding, because obviously as the permanent secretary, I was dealing quite a bit with senior officials and ministers. But there were a lot of aspects of the job that I probably just didn't know about. But I hope I learned quickly, and I had a brilliant team of civil servants that got me adjusted quickly to the rhythms and life within the civil service. So I didn't feel very long as an outsider or a stranger to that intimate part of Whitehall that I got to know very well.
And so today we're lucky, I guess, to say we've got two former teachers on. Jonathan is a former teacher himself. Jonathan, we did an episode with Jonathan where I think from an early start he knew he was interested in kind of Whitehall politics. You've really moved up from, you know teaching, from being a teacher all the way through now to various very, very senior roles in the education system. When you became a teacher, did you have an idea of a career path, or is it, how did you know, did you kind of know even roughly where you wanted to go?
I was a primary school teacher, James, and I remember the first few days in the job thinking, oh, I've died and gone to heaven. You know, just that opportunity to work with a group of young children and be responsible for them in every way just seemed like a wonderful opportunity, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I suppose it's when I made the move south and I came to work in Essex that I got my first experience of engaging with both local government and national government policymakers. And I thought, this is actually rather interesting. I then came up for the first time to the northeast of England and ended up as Director of Education in Newcastle City Council. And of course, that really did give you that wider exposure. But again, I thought my career was probably going to be in local government, not central government. And then the chief inspector of schools job came up and I thought, right, this is the one, this is the opportunity that I'd like to pursue. And I suppose after that, I got more and more interested. I'd also been very fortunate, James, that I spent a year in the United States as a Harkness Fellow, which was at that stage very much designed for people who had a policy interest and wanted to go and see it in a different jurisdiction. And that really did light the fire for me when it came to policy and an interest in national policy and seeing education reform in particular in the United States in the early 90s was a wonderful opportunity. And probably that was the moment where I decided that my career might take a different track.
Interesting. And so moving on to the permanent secretary, the topic of today, myself, having been a special advisor, when I go somewhere with people who are not in politics, and frankly, a lot of people who do work in politics, the common question, I got asked it on the TV the other day, and I'll be honest, I struggled to understand it, is what is a special advisor? Being able to explain that in 2 minutes is quite hard because it's quite a broad role. And I wonder if as a starting point, I wonder if that's the case for you. You must go to things and people say, which is what we're going to investigate today in more detail, what does a permanent secretary do? Like, is it easy to describe to, you know, someone who doesn't know the industry what a permanent secretary's job is? Is that an easier or
hard
thing to do?
Well, I used to say to people, it's the opposite of being a temporary secretary, being the permanent secretary. More seriously, my shorthand description, James, was I was the most senior civil servant in the Department for Education. And I think most people understood it. And then if they asked you to explain what all of that meant, then I would go on and explain that. But I think most people got it when you said you were the most senior civil servant working alongside the Secretary of State and the ministerial team.
And so when you get there on your first day, how much of an adjustment is it to, because that is a very, for people that don't know, having worked in the department, it's a very senior role. Because I think I remember speaking to someone we both know, Michael Gove, about this. You're really running a company of a quite big size. It would put you in certainly the FTSE 350 in terms of the number of employees you got, the budget you're responsible for, you're responsible for a wide, at that point, you're beyond education, right? You are responsible for everything that happens in that department. Is that a big adjustment?
I think I had the advantage, James, of having run larger organizations before, so running a city council, running a local authority, Ofsted. I was effectively the chief executive as well as the chief inspector. Mm. So what you might describe as the management responsibilities that came with the job were probably more straightforward than they might be for others. Although, of course, you've got this rather unusual, one might even say unique, dynamic between the permanent secretary and the Secretary of State. And some people say, well, is it like a company where you have a chairman of the board? And I said, well, it's not really like that, because most companies will have a non-executive chairman. Effectively, this is, if you think of it this way, it's almost as if the chief executive and the chairman of the board are working in parallel with each other. Mm. And it's not even that straightforward, because, of course, there are different but overlapping interests, because the minister has been elected and then appointed by the prime minister, whereas the permanent secretary has been directly appointed through a civil service appointments process. So I think it is probably fair to say it is a unique kind of relationship that you have, and maybe for that reason the role of the permanent secretary doesn't have any obvious parallels anywhere else in the private or public sectors.
Mm. So, David, I was interested in your first day, because in my albeit brief time in the Department for Education as the Minister for School Standards, I remember walking into the building and there was the Permanent Secretary, there were a couple of the Director Generals, and being taken up to my office to meet my private office, but essentially being told that the Permanent Secretary, obviously, as you say, is working hand in hand in partnership with the Secretary of State, and ultimately, as a junior minister, I'll be spending my time more with the Director Generals related to the briefs that I'm overseeing, and I'll see the Permanent Secretary in the weekly meeting. And of course, if there's an emergency or if for some reason, obviously, book an appointment out of interest. What was your first day when you walk into the building? What's the process that you went through?
Well, I should just say, Jonathan, that being met on the steps of the building or at the front door was something that I initiated. Maybe it was something for my school teacher, head teacher's background, where I always liked to be on the gate in the morning. And I wanted to be on the gate in the afternoon, see them in, see them out. So I always thought it was really important that the first person that the Secretary of State and indeed ministers met was the Permanent Secretary, partly as a courtesy. You know, you are coming, appointed by the Prime Minister to do a ministerial role. So it was an important courtesy, but it was also an opportunity just to establish that relationship. I was in quite an unusual position coming in, because I came in the January of 2006. Ruth Kelly was the Secretary of State at that point, and almost before I knew it, we were into one of those Whitehall crises. So we had a situation where there was allegations of people who'd been on the sex offenders register had been cleared to work in schools, and this became quite a big story at the time. And at the same point, there was quite a controversial schools bill about to get its second reading in Parliament. So there was a sense in which day one, I was headlong into it. And I often look back at the end of the first month and said to the Secretary of State, you know, you put on a wonderful induction program for me. I really learned an awful lot. So thank you. So when does the real job start? So there was a virtue for me, I think, Jonathan, in having exposure immediately. I was working really closely with the Secretary of State, with advisors, with officials, with the ministerial team, the media office, number 10. So I got this really fortunate induction. And maybe because I was an outsider, that was even more beneficial. So I didn't have the opportunity to think about, well, I used to do that when I was a director general or a director. Actually, I learned on the job, quite literally learned on the job in that first month or so.
And so when you're in the role, obviously you didn't say there that you're talking with the Secretary of State. Is that who you technically report to, or are you reporting to the Cabinet Secretary, who's obviously sort of the head of all?
So you said you were appointed by Sir Gus at the time,
Lord O'Donnell.
And G-O-D, God, Gus O'Donnell.
Yes.
I mean, God.
And is that therefore who you would report to, or is technically you've got this partnership model, but technically is the hierarchy that you're reporting into the Secretary of State because that's the person who's been appointed by the Prime Minister, or am I just living in a dreamland somehow?
It's a really interesting question, Jonathan. Formally, my line reporting responsibility was to the Cabinet Secretary, but okay. Of course, in the evaluation of performance of a Permanent Secretary, the Cabinet Secretary is talking a lot to the relevant Secretary of State. But the formal line, I guess, to protect that distinction between the civil service on the one hand and the political leadership on the other, is to the Cabinet Secretary. But inevitably, you serve really at the pleasure of the Secretary of State. Although that may not be a formal requirement, I think it's obvious, isn't it? As it would be in most organisations, if you don't have the confidence of the person who has the most senior role, then it's very difficult to do your job.
And so out of interest then, what's the relationship with number 10? So you obviously got this department you're overseeing, you're working in partnership with the Secretary of State and the ministerial team. What's your relationship or encounters with the number 10, for example, on a weekly basis? How often would you engage with, as you did at the time, Lord O'Donnell, as he is now known?
Yes, you would. Dealing quite a bit with the Cabinet Secretary, and every Wednesday there was the famous, or some might even say infamous, Wednesday morning meeting of Permanent Secretaries, much less glamorous than everyone thought it was. But an interesting opportunity to share perspectives across Whitehall. And then you would engage with the Cabinet Secretary on what you might describe as civil service-wide business. In terms of Downing Street, Jonathan, it was usually driven by crises. So if Downing Street was on the phone, you usually knew it was a problem. So occasionally, and James will know all about this, and you too, Jonathan, you would get a phone call at the weekend, and it would be the number 10 switchboard. And you would know, well, that's probably not the Prime Minister asking if I'm having a nice weekend. There's probably something afoot. So often the number 10 engagement was on the back of issues that were in the news or topical, not always crisis, but topical. And then there might be particular areas where the Prime Minister or the Number 10 Policy Unit was working up some education-related policy where you would work with them. So it tended to be dependent on the circumstances rather than a sort of regular piece. I mean, the classic line that you'll both know was Number 10 wants. Yeah. And I had more than one Secretary of State who would say, no, Number 10 is an inert object. Tell me who in Number 10 won.
That sounds like my former boss, Michael.
Oh, I can't possibly comment.
I will comment on it because it's something that you would get as a special advisor as well. Maybe not the same calls as yourself, David, in terms of mine would normally be spad to spad, but you'd get the classic thing would be from the private office, which is Number 10, you want you to look at this policy or do this. And I quickly learned through the help of Michael that the question I would ask is, well, who in Number 10? And particularly, I don't know if you've had this experience, when you're about to announce something, as I was doing media for Michael at DEFRA, it would be like, oh, you know, we want to change this or do this. My response was put my phone number on the email, my mobile number, send it to them, tell them I'm doing it like I said I'm going to do. And if they've got a problem, they need to call me up directly. Because I found, I'm not saying Michael taught me that particular thing, but I found that flushed out that was I talking about someone senior in Number 10 who had the ear, let's say, of the Prime Minister or the Chief of Staff or the Cabinet Secretary, or was I talking to someone much junior who really could stay out of it?
I think there was an interesting parallel here, James, between Michael Gove and Ed Balls. I mean, both of them were big political figures. Both of them were independently minded and serious thinkers about policy. Both of them, at the time they were Secretaries of State, had a very close working relationship with the Prime Minister. And therefore, the dynamic between a Secretary of State and indeed the department and Number 10 was a bit different if you had a Secretary of State who perhaps had a slightly different relationship and wasn't in the same kind of position vis-a-vis Downing Street. So I think I benefited and the department benefited from having big political figures that knew their own mind and were quite prepared to say to Number 10, well, politely, go away. You know, this is my major policy area. And if there's a problem with it, I'll speak directly to the Prime Minister about it.
Because I wonder if that's a similarity, because when people ask me as a former special advisor about the kind of dynamics between you and the Secretary of State, I would always say I worked in departments for Priti Patel and Michael Gove, and they've got many differences, but the similarity is they're both very much, as you were saying about Ed as well, Paul's, is I think both people I worked for had a very clear idea where they were going. So I didn't ever personally see my role as steering them in any way. It was advice around that, how to deliver that, you know, maybe a few pointers, and I had policy areas that I kind of particularly looked after. But I think in terms of if it's like a ship, I mean, they absolutely knew what port they were heading to, and I didn't have, is that, as a permanent secretary and senior levels of the civil service, is that seen as a good thing when you have a Secretary of State that really knows where they're going? Or do they want to shape that?
No, I think you're absolutely right. What the civil service wants more than anything is certainty and decisiveness. And I often heard stories of perhaps where the direction was not quite as clear and it was really difficult, not just for the permanent secretary, but for the rest of the department. So I think absolutely right. You want a minister, and particularly a Secretary of State, who knows their mind. And I think that just goes to the heart of the role of the civil service, James. You are there to serve the government of the day, and the clearer the government of the day is about what it wants to do, then in a sense, leave aside political and public controversy, the more straightforward it is for the civil service to help the Secretary of State and the ministerial team deliver the policies.
I was about to say, I've got, when I got in there, James was actually the one who told me in the Department of Education, find out what your brief is and all your portfolio, then come up with five very clear, distinct things. You can't do everything, and I'm keen to get your view on this, because obviously there's such a wide breadth. Find five things that you think are super important to you or to the government or the Prime Minister that you've got to deliver. And the other things, hopefully, are things that are ticking over. You can drop in on weekly, fortnightly, monthly with the meetings to see how things are going. And I remember that when I got a whiteboard in to the department, into my office, classic teacher that still is me, I had my five priorities up. I remember every time that came in the room, members of the civil servants were like looking at it and taking photos of it. So they all like, this is what he wants to focus on. And to give listeners the idea of just how important it is, once someone gave me this lovely timeline about the history of academisation, and I just said casually, oh, that's a really good timeline, it's very helpful. It wasn't until the next day I realised I was on my fourth meeting and people were deliberately pointing at the back of the pack where there was the appendix and another timeline. And I kept saying, I said to my prior boss, why is there this obsession with showing me these timelines? And they said, well, you said you like them, so the whole department now knows that that's what you want. Now, I was in that level of just that type of comment, like, I found quite amusing that I became known for being obsessed with timelines, which they were nice, but I just, you know, as I say, it wasn't my be all and end all, but it was quite funny how that kind of instruction, like you say, quickly ripples through from a director general meeting all the way to the ground floor, which is where the people are doing really important work of compiling information, putting all the stats and facts together for me to be able to make decisions or give advice. And I suppose, is that something similar you've experienced yourself,
Jonathan,
David?
Completely. I mean, civil servants are great readers of people, you know, and working out what it is the minister wants is really important. And of course, you'll know, and James from a different perspective will know, the role of the private office, the team that supports the minister, is incredibly important. And I remember thinking on more than one occasion, the civil service is not run by the cabinet secretary, it's run by a bunch of 20-somethings.
It's true.
Because most of them are young, because you need to work every hour of the day and you have to be incredibly energetic. So they are really good at interpreting. And maybe just comment on your thought about priorities, Jonathan. I think it's a very interesting idea there. I mean, I'll give you two examples, one from the Labour administration, one from the Conservative administration, and both of them interestingly to do with academies. One was Lord Adonis. Andrew Adonis, who obviously was a big driver of academisation in the first Labour iteration, both in Downing Street as a special advisor, and then for both Tony Blair when Andrew became a minister, and interestingly, before he became Transport Secretary, for Gordon Brown. And Andrew was a total obsessive about this, in the best sense. You know, there was an 8 o'clock meeting, everyone was round his table, and it was just driving it. So he was absolutely focused on that. Jonathan Hill is the example, Lord Hill, from the early days of Michael Gove's time at the department, when the Academies Act had led to a very rapid expansion of the Academies programme. And Jonathan, likewise, he knew that for the government, it was essential that that policy was delivered and was delivered at pace. The whole point of getting the Academies Act through before the summer 2010 recess was to enable that to happen. And he too had that kind of relentless focus. And I think it's very good advice. Perhaps harder for the Secretary of State, because the Secretary of State, in a sense, has the whole ministerial waterfront to worry about. But even good Secretaries of State will do likewise. They will think, what are the two or three things that are going to define my time in office?
You've touched on something there. So one of the things that's been on my mind over the past few months, looking, you know, we'd really try on the pod not to get involved in party politics, but to look at the function of changing governments, which you've seen up close. So it's if you look at the polls, it's quite likely, Jonathan doesn't need to comment on this, that we might have a change of government towards the end of this year when there's an election. And I was talking to some people in Labour, and it struck me that something Michael had mentioned to me ages ago. Michael said when they came in 2010, he had that Academies Bill drafted. It was done. It was ready to go. They'd had actually former Labour advisors had kind of helped them prepare for government and so on, which I think he's talked about publicly. And we hear that Labour are doing it at the moment. So you were part of both actually under Labour, but even then under a brand new government where people hadn't been in government before. You were part of a department that was, I think, wherever you are in politics, would say, was able to bring in a new policy and implement that, as you said, at pace. That is now widely seen, the Academies project, across the political spectrum as a good policy that's delivered great outcomes for education, but also a policy that was delivered very, very well. And I wondered if you had any reflections, just not politically, but in terms of practicalities, about how civil servants and politicians, how is that able to happen? Because it's not common to happen, I would suggest.
Yes. I mean, first thing just to say about transitions, James, is, of course, we've become quite used in this country to the single party of government in for quite a long time. The Conservatives from 1979, then Labour from 1997, then the Conservatives obviously since 2010. So these transitional moments are quite unusual. And many senior civil servants will never have done one because they were much more junior and the last one was done. So there was quite a lot of thought and preparation given. Now, in relation to the academies, and again, I've spoken publicly about this, so there's no real secret here. Michael came into the transition talks extremely well prepared, and he used the time to try to sharpen his own understanding, because there's a delicate piece here, James, that civil servants are not allowed to provide policy advice to their shadow Secretary of State, because obviously you're serving the government of the day. But through, you know, helpful interrogation and clarification, I think shadow ministers can get to where they need to get to. Now, you're right, Michael came not just with the list of priorities, of which the Academy's bill was the talk. He came in with a piece of draft legislation, which then was a helpful starting point for civil servants. Now, again, just to be very clear, civil servants cannot do any policy-related work or preparatory work when they're still serving the government of the day. And that's a really important constitutional principle that we must uphold. But when you get the pre-election period, so once the government, once the election's been called, then you've got what used to be called the purdah period of 5 or 6 weeks, well, 4 or 5 weeks, depending on the length of the election. You've then got time to work up all your policy briefings. And I think in education, we were ahead of the game because, one, Michael had great clarity about what he wanted to do and his first priority. And secondly, he also had given me, just before the election, a list of the other things that he wanted to do. And therefore, there was quite a sharp focus for the civil service in preparing all of that. But don't forget, even in the run-up to 2010, we were having to prepare policy advice if the Liberal Democrats were in government. Everyone assumed that wouldn't happen, but there you go. Then there was also the policy advice that you were continuing to prepare because the current government might have been re-elected. So you're having to make sure that you're doing appropriate levels of work. And I'm really pleased that we actually ended up doing that work on the Liberal Democrats' policies because, of course, famously, we got the coalition government where education policy and some aspects of education policy were central to it, particularly around things like the pupil premium.
It was David Laws, wasn't it, who came in with Michael, if I remember correctly?
What happened there, Jonathan, if you remember, David Laws was the chief secretary to the Treasury. And then, actually, after a very, I think, 5 or 6 days, I think, because of some personal matters. And then Sarah Tether was the first Liberal Democrat minister. And it was Sarah was there the whole time that I was there as Perm Sec on the Lib Dem side.
On the handover, so I haven't been there for a transitional government. I have been in department when we knew a reshuffle was coming. And I wondered, was curious on your reflections of this. From my side, politically, it feels quite cold. So I remember with Michael, we actually stayed during the reshuffle. But we had an absolutely, really, genuinely amazing private office. And I remember speaking to the head of private office and he was putting this pack together and I was like, what's that pack? And he said, well, it's the pack for the potential new Secretary of State. And he was like, you know, we don't expect it, James, but we do have to be prepared. As you said yourself, you're prepared for the civil service now. We'll be preparing for both the Conservative and Labour government, I'm sure, looking at Lib Dem plans as well. But it felt, maybe this is just me personally, it feels quite cold because it is, they're just preparing to ship you out in stuff in a box. And, you know, I'm personally, obviously, I was, as Gullis, Jonathan knows, was quite attached to Defra. I was quite fond of
He's yearning for it, David. He's yearning for a return to Defra.
I'd love to go back to Defra. Outside of, you doing your job properly and preparing, do you must build up personal relationships, I guess is what I'm
saying. Yes, you do. We always wanted a reshuffle period to be long enough for us to clear the office of any personal effects and tidy it up. So, I mean, talk about cold, James. It was that cold.
Yeah.
You know, there could be no trace of the predecessor. And you may know, Jonathan will know this, but when you come into the Department for Education, there is a photo gallery of all the previous secretaries of state. And as I used to say to the Secretary of State of the day, that's the wall you don't want to be on, because that's the wall after you've gone. So, yes, there is. And a bit like prime ministerial changes, it's pretty brutal. Now, of course, when you're talking about the reshuffles, don't forget, I was there when you had a change of prime minister, which, of course, has been something the civil service has had to deal with more regularly in the last few years. But the Blair-Brown transition was an interesting period of time, because not only were you assuming you would get a new Secretary of State, as we did, but you were also assuming a new prime minister might take a different view of education policy. So you're absolutely right. You were there thinking about not just what a new Secretary of State would do, presuming that broadly they would do what their predecessor had done because it was the same party. But when you had a change of prime minister, you were thinking, the prime minister might have a different set of views about education, and can we prepare some briefing papers? My line on briefing papers was to keep them pretty short, because when you come in as a new minister, even if you read all the briefing papers, it would probably go in one ear and out the other, because you just couldn't process all of that. I always said the briefing pack was better a few days or a few weeks in, once you'd got your head round the complexity of the department. And if you needed an instant brief because you were in front of the House of Commons making a statement on this or at education questions, then you could refer to the briefing pack. So the briefing pack was important, but it's back to that bit you asked about me coming into the job. You have to get into the job to learn how to do the job, and then you just get on with the job.
To back you up there, David, I remember obviously when Liz Truss became Prime Minister, and during that leadership contest, there had been talks about whether or not to lift the ban on grammar school. So I remember when we walked into the department, that was one of the things that both the Permanent Secretary and all Director General was very keen to understand. Is this a top priority? Because obviously it would be a major change in legislation. There would obviously potentially be wider implications. And I remember it being about 2 weeks in our first sort of round table, you know, the standard one with Director Generals, Permanent Secretary, and all the ministerial team. And Kit Malthouse, who was then the Secretary of State at the time, being asked, do you want us to draft up all the options? And Kit's going, Kit being in a department where I was very much on the record of wanting to lift the ban. Andrew Jenkins has said the same thing as well. And Kit saying, we've got a cost of living or energy at that time crisis where schools are really feeling the pinch. We've obviously got, we had at that time a huge underspend in the capital budget, and obviously a lot of schools that historically need rebuilding or with RAC, for example. He was like, these will be the things that, one, meet the target for growth, obviously investing in new buildings and creating that, but also those are the things that we need to spend our time on. So he goes, I'm not sure if, and it was interesting when he was talking then to the Director General's openly about the political will of Parliament. I'm not sure if it's there to get this through. And slowly but surely it became apparent that although this is something that could be on the back burner, for at least the first 6 months, this was something now to be parked to one side. And that clarity actually, I think, was helpful for the civil service to know that whilst we've got ministers in our team who are very keen for this, ultimately that's not going to come down the track anytime soon and focus on the immediate response, which, as you know, I remember with the energy stuff in particular, talking about whether or not to have emergency plans for schools to open up for half a day or earlier in the morning in case we had blackouts with electricity, as was being talked about in the papers at the time. Very serious stuff, like you say, that obviously would understandably take the priority of the department and, of course, the Permanent Secretary.
And that's why the conversations that in one sense might be considered capital P political are important for more senior officials to be in at times, because you're getting then the political steer to prepare the policy to implement the government's agenda. So I don't think there's any issue about... I think civil servants were always sensitive, and I remain sensitive throughout, to just making sure that line was clear between what was appropriately the political direction and what was the civil service advice to ministers in making political decisions, or making decisions which obviously had political consequences. And I think, you know, that's why ministers, and I'm sure this would have been the case for both of you, ministers were always very concerned to work out what the consequences of decisions would be, because in a sense, you are more likely, bluntly, as the Secretary of State or the ministers, to feel the political consequences and the media consequences and the public reaction to policy. And that's why that's really important. You think about that as a continuum, and you don't see policy as something sort of, you know, crafted beautifully in private with no connection to the outside world. Policy is only any good if it can be implemented and implemented successfully.
I totally agree. I think I saw this most during Brexit, and I'm interested for your views, David. And I would say I see this not just from the civil service, but actually policy special advisors in the Conservative Party, you know, party political policy special advisors, which is often your job as a SPAD is to look at something and say, here's the political consequences. What's the chance of it getting through Parliament? What are Number 10 going to say? Et cetera, et cetera. How are the media going to react? You know, is it? Are we going to spend 3 days getting battered by the Telegraph, and then the PM is going to call us up and say you're not doing this kind of stuff? And so we had an absolutely exceptional civil servant that was part of looking at the EU negotiations for DEFRA, and was always keenly aware of some of the political consequences, the decisions that might have been made, and you know, wasn't political. But was very much gave us civil service advice, but gave it in a way that was aware of what else was going on, which I thought was incredibly useful to Michael and to us. And I wondered, you know, how do you feel, is the civil service always geared enough to be not political, but politically sensitive? And is that important? You touched on some of the qualities that make, you know, good at reading people, that make a good civil servant. Is that one of the things that makes a very good civil servant?
I think that's such an interesting point, James. I mean, just on special advisors, I mean, some people get terribly excited about them. I always said to the civil service, the virtue of special advisors is that they provide a kind of political firewall. So the sorts of things that you might worry about as a civil servant in developing policy, but think cross the line into the politics, capital P, you can take that steer, or you can take soundings from the special advisors. And I think it's a really important way of supporting the proper separation between the civil service and the minister. So yeah. I think that works incredibly well. Yeah, so an interesting point about political awareness. I think on occasions, and you probably both would have seen this, civil servants can become very attached to their policy. And you had to say to them, it's not your policy, it's the government's policy. And actually, the government might change tomorrow, and you will have a new policy. And therefore, there is enough that you've got to get that balance right between having people who are committed enough to implement a policy and be politically aware about it, but not becoming politically naive about it. And I think senior civil servants, and you might say that's why they become senior civil servants, generally are good at reading the sort of political mood and understanding what's workable and what isn't in government.
I think in my time in the Department for Education, there were certain policies that people attached to. Actually, I found in some of the amazing people I had in my private office were very attached to Nick Gibb because he'd been so rare. But basically, for having been, well, a decade, I think it was, in the Department for Education, it's hard not to become attached to someone like Nick because it's so rare, so unusual for a minister to have lasted that long and overseen all those changes and been around. So I say that affectionately, and I think that was a nice thing. I like the fact that my private office had that huge respect for the fact that some, and that consistency had been so important for the department, that regardless of the other changes in that policy brief as he was Minister for School Standards, there was a consistency on everyone knew what Nick stood for, very much what Michael introduced, and that was the direction of travel and there was no diverting off that. And at least that gave clarity. So I think that's just to back up. And like you say, I always found that with my private office that, like you say, that capital P politics, not getting into debate over, you know, whether Conservative, Labour or whoever are good or bad, but actually talking about the reality. And actually, I used to say to my private office, don't be afraid to ask me questions about things like how does the house work? How can you tell about the mood of the house? Because ultimately, that makes them better civil servants when they're sat in the box, which is on the government side. But if you look to the left of the speaker, there'll be the members of the department there. You know, it's good for them to feel it, to see it, to understand it. Because ultimately, that will help to hopefully creating better policy, as well as when understanding why a minister may do the dreaded thing of saying, I'll write to that person, I'll set up a meeting with you in order to add to the diary, or indeed, obviously, make concessions on the floor of the House regarding policy, whether those be amendments or not.
I just think all of that I agree with, Jonathan. The risk, I think, comes if we have a change of government, because I think I saw this in 2010, that civil servants, and this is, again, a function of long period of single-party rule, civil servants usually start to understand how the government thinks and what is it, what the government wants. If you get a change of government, sometimes civil servants just need to take a bit of time to think that the new government doesn't necessarily want to do what the old government did. And I think if I reflect on, you know, the many mistakes I made in my time, I think I underestimated the sort of cultural transition between one administration and the other. And this is not about politics. This is not about, oh, they wanted Labour, they wanted the Conservatives. But I'll give you a very concrete example of this. The Labour government in the Ked Balls era, 2007-2010, had really promoted the idea of a children's database. It had come out of some of the original problems around the classification of offenders and so on, and trying to just make sure that children were better identified. Now, Michael was very clear during the pre-election talks, we don't want that. And so we had that really interesting position of saying to the very same civil servants who'd worked up that policy for years, you are going to now dismantle and put that away. And actually, I always said it was one of the great virtues of the civil service that the people who put it together took it apart and closed it down. And they were incredibly professional on that front. I think in some other areas, civil servants just were a bit surprised to find that a new government didn't want to do what the previous government did. Maybe that's back to James's point about political sophistication and understanding. You have to understand that when the government changes, there will be new policy, and therefore you have to be ready to implement it.
And on that point, the culture point I think is really interesting. I was thinking about this as I was thinking about speaking to you today, and so we've got that dynamic of that kind of co-running of the department, but obviously you can have a permanent secretary there like yourself that sees a number of different secretaries of state who will have a different outlook on the way things should be done, not just policy. So who drives the kind of culture of a department? Is that, do you have to respond to that changes? Because we, you know, as you touched on, we're likely to see that big change that many senior civil servants will not have actually seen, a big change of government. And you know, whatever your views on these things, I would imagine that would lead to a change of culture in departments. And so how do you deal with that? Because you've dealt with it quite uniquely.
Yes, it's a hard one, actually, James, because I always used to caution people when they talked about the departmental line. My view was there isn't such a thing as a departmental line. There's the government's policy, which the department is there to implement. Equally, as the, quote, chief executive of the department, I wanted, as any person running an organisation would want, to build a positive culture and all the things that go with that. But inevitably, a Secretary of State, and particularly a Secretary of State who's got a big personality, Gove Balls come to mind, will impose that, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense, but that will be imposed on the department, and the department will take its steer from the kind of energy and political commitment of the Secretary of State. So it's a really interesting dynamic, and probably will also depend on how long the Secretary of State stays in post. So Ed Balls did 3 years, Michael did just over 3 years at DfE. So, you know, that's in the political sense, in the ministerial,
that's a long time.
That's an eternity. Yeah. And yeah, actually, they did have the chance to really drive it. It also helped in both cases, back to an earlier point in the conversation, they had a very clear policy agenda. Both Ed and Michael very clearly knew what they want to do. And again, in a sense, the department picks that up and hopefully under decent civil service leadership is pointing in the direction of helping the government to implement its policies.
And related to the style of the Secretary of State, I remember speaking to someone at DEFRA once, and they said one of the things they liked about Michael was they didn't usually have in that department of DEFRA, this is civil servant's words to me, something that they were working on a policy who could go into cabinet and win the battle. And Michael could. I mean, Michael's, you know, he because of his history, because of his background, because of his ways, on big policy debates when there was maybe other departments that, you know, weren't too keen on something, not all the time, but they felt they had someone that if they were working on something, it would go into cabinet and have a chance of survival, which is, I don't necessarily think that means they're committed to the policy. It's just that you spend a lot of time working on it. And that, I think, felt good for the department, perhaps. And they, you know, they said the last time they had that, I think, was actually probably Hilary Benn under Labour as a department, that they had a kind of real heavyweight at the top of it.
I think that's...
I just wondered kind of from your perspective as well as a permanent secretary, you know, is that, or the senior rungs of the civil service, is that, do you think that's, is that something that translates as well to the department if they feel they've got someone that can do that?
Absolutely. And I think Ed Balls was very similar to the way you've described Michael when it came to those bigger cross Whitehall or cabinet battles. We also had a very different kind of secretary of state in Alan Johnson, who was a superb Secretary of State, very different to Ed and Michael. And he got trust in a different sort of way because he was just so effective and efficient, and he took on knotty problems and he just tackled them head on. But he wasn't, and I think Alan would be the first to say this, he wasn't the same kind of political thinker as an Ed Balls. Or a Michael Gove, but he was a very effective minister that the department responded to because Alan just got stuff done. So you don't have to be the great big political thinker, but maybe there's something for all ministers about just thinking through, as we discussed earlier, how do you get things done for however long you're in the department?
You made me both think about, actually, the relationship, like you say, that you do build between the ministerial team and the civil service, because... And those battles, the battles for the department to win in the wider Whitehall machine. I remember, as I say, going in to talk about if, God forbid, we had severe energy shortages, that we were going to have the lights switched off in different parts of the country for a day at a time, whatever like that. You know, we've got to make sure that schools are prioritised and protected, because they're not at the moment, maybe compared to other key services and all that. And actually... you foster such a key relationship there. And like you say, if it's a positive culture to go with it, because ultimately there are times when there is crises and it might be that you need emergency funding, or you might need something tweaking, or you might need number 10 to personally intervene. To have that, that's when I found that that lovely relationship that can develop very quickly between the civil service and the minister, to go, right, we're going to go in as one. And you've had your pre-brief meeting beforehand and you're like, these are the lines, I'll come in here, you come in there, and you work together in a positive sense. Like you say, no politics, just working in the interest of the department. And I was wondering, David, how important do you think that is as well in order to build trust, but also just for Whitehall in general, that you have ministers who fully embrace, as I say, the department they're working for and the civil servants that are working with them, rather than some of the media narrative that we sadly see a lot of, which is that there's apparently constant internal warfare between the two.
You're absolutely right. There are sometimes, whether we like it or not, Whitehall battles to be fought about the allocation of money. And that often comes to the fore during spending reviews. It was always a joy to go into a spending review discussion with Alan Johnson, because you saw Alan at work with the Chief Secretary of the Treasury, and you remember that Alan had been the General Secretary of the Postal Workers Union and could negotiate anyone out the room. I mean, it was a masterclass in negotiation. More generally, you're right, Jonathan, it's important that there is that sense of common identity. And you know, I think, again, it's probably the nature of things. Sometimes ministers come to departments and it's just not a natural fit. And perhaps it's obvious that they are not entirely comfortable being there, and the department picks it up and there's a sort of energy levels drop. Whereas I think some of the characters we've been speaking about today actually had a very clear program for government and actually cared a lot about education and wanted things to happen. So actually going into those wider Whitehall discussions was actually much better to do so when you had a minister who actually had the confidence to speak. And also, and this might seem a really basic point, but a minister or a secretary of state who in a meeting with another cabinet minister or the prime minister just was on top of their brief, you know? Mm. I mean, that might seem a really basic point, but, you know, some people were less on top of their brief than others. Yep. And of course, both Ed Vols and Michael Johnson and Michael Gove and Alan Johnson, all of them were on top of their brief. And I think they came across really confidently whenever they were engaging in Whitehall discussions.
It's funny you say that, because I remember James telling me again when I got the call to go in, he was like, that is the absolute thing you need to be on top of. To build trust with your civil servants, to show competency in the House, you have to know your brief. That means there is uncomfortable reading till early in the morning and constantly trying to stay on, chase up things. But I think you're right. And by the way, for the listeners, even politicians in the House pick up on the ministers that are clearly across the detail and those who are quite not quite so across it, in the sense of the private meetings that we have, but also when the way in which questions are answered in the House. In particular, one giveaway is look at which ministers are not using their folder as much as others when it comes to giving responses, because they clearly have retained all the details. Now, of course, some of that will be they've been in the department maybe longer, much longer than others. But also the way that I would say they interact in the WhatsApp groups nowadays that are now famous and across Whitehall, there are some ministers that I think must drop in messages on an almost weekly basis. I'm going to mention Anthony Brown. He's actually in the House as we speak, but he is constantly in our WhatsApp talking about automated vehicles and other such things. And I think that shows a passion, which then gets you engaged and interested about Bencher, which hopefully gets more attention for the department, which therefore helps to make it more of a priority for Number 10, because they can see if they're on the governing side, their own MPs engaging more and more and more in the process.
I think, Jonathan, that's such an important point that civil servants don't always see. And that is, how do ministers make things happen in Parliament with their political allies? And actually, sometimes their political opponents, you know, but yep. Keeping people informed, keeping people briefed, trying to broker conversations if there's a tricky moment and the minister wants to get something done and the opposition look as if they're not there, but can you make all of that happen? Civil servants don't see that. And I know that Alan Johnson was absolutely fanatical about being in the House, going over for breakfast, meeting people, having lots of conversations. And I think the best ministers work incredibly hard at doing that. But that's often completely invisible to the vast majority of civil servants, because obviously it's usually done in the Palace of Westminster.
You normally have the fun where you have the debate where you're going, I'm going to be in the House. They go, but you're diary minister. And then you're trying to explain to your private office, but this is about a tea room surgery, as they would be nicknamed by our side, or over in the House. Or like you say, just basically being around and saying to people, oh, have you seen this? Or just being physically there. So if someone suddenly goes, oh, by the way, I've got this issue with my school, for example, and you can go, oh, yeah, or drop me a note. And like you say, that soft power, essentially, to building that rapport with the department and the minister. And obviously then feeding back the mood of the House and the feeling of the House into the department around maybe certain policy areas that can give a better steer of where things are going.
And this whole conversation seems to be really so timely, because again, long stretch of single party government means that almost inevitably the majority of ministers who would be coming into power if there's a change of government will have had no experience of government. And that was the same in 1997 as well. So I think it's understandable why people who are perhaps preparing for government are thinking carefully. And I think it's not just the formalities about how do you do business, how does a private office work. It's almost this touch and feel that we are talking about here of being a minister that maybe is the difference between success and failure.
So a final question for me, David, is, I spoke to someone I respect in politics a lot about their career, and I said to them, you know, do you look at different bits of Whitehall, different bits of departments, and think, why are you not doing this? Why are you not doing that? And they said, no, that's not the thing you feel. They said, you often look at what's going on and say, I've made that mistake before, and you want to jump in and say, I've done this. And, you know, you touch, there's loads of things. If I feel I'd be infinitely better at any of my jobs now than I was when I did them, which, you know, then you can't go and do them again. That's a personal thing. And there's so many things that you've learned from. I hear Spads doing things and think, oh, I did that. It was a stupid idea at the time. Wish I didn't do it or whatever. And I wonder if it's that, how do you see that sometimes yourself without maybe naming examples? And how are you able to pass on that knowledge to people now? You know, and as you said, it's timely in terms of some of the things that I'm sure you would have learnt about that transition of government. And I think you were involved in the early years review for the Labour Party. Is that some of the ways in which you can pass on that huge body of knowledge which you've built in your career?
In all the jobs that I've done, James, I've always said, don't criticise your predecessors, because one day you will be a predecessor. And you don't want people to trash your reputation. So I am actually quite careful about all of that. I think you do look and say, might have done that differently because we did something different. But look, in the end, we all make the decisions we make based on the information that we've got at the time. And you work on the principle that most people working in government, whether it's ministers or MPs, ministers or civil servants, actually are there to do good. And actually they want to improve the company. Now the country. Now there'll be huge debate and discussion about the means by which we do that, and that's at the very heart of democracy and having those arguments. But actually I think everyone in the main, in my experience, has been committed to doing the right thing. So I probably am a believer in giving people a lot of slack, because I know what it's like, you people know what it's like, to be there, and doesn't really help you a lot when you're getting sniping from the sidelines.
No, it doesn't. So the last question is, after everything you've heard today, are you disappointed that you didn't get to serve as Permanent Secretary with Jonathan Gullis as a minister in the Department for Education? Do you feel you've, missed out, David?
Well, the circumstances in the country at the time did not allow me to serve that particular minister. But of course, if I had been called upon to serve, I would have done it dutifully and loyally.
I think that's the biggest compliment you've got on this the entire
nicest,
series.
That is the nicest thing that anyone said, and that's going to be on the top of every CV that I have forthcoming.
I've been at civil service flattery school.
It's very good. I mean, if everyone should sign up to that. I mean, that's going to be on the CV. That's going on the CV. But look, thank you so much, David, for joining us. We really appreciate it. It was absolutely fascinating insight. And look, if you are tuning in and listening and you're a current minister or a wannabe hopeful minister for the Labour Party, then
you help Labour now.
Well, I'm just saying, the pod is helping. The pod is giving you advice on what to do, what to be prepared for, and actually understand about that relationship to build within the department. And of course, for all the people who are currently studying their A-levels, we know tune in, all the doing their degrees, hopefully this will give you a better insight into what you see in the newspapers about the civil service and its relationship with Parliament and the wider Whitehall machine actually may not always be as accurate or as fairly representative as what the newspapers would suggest. So a big thank you to everyone for listening in. Please make sure you leave us a rating and review. Most importantly, hit the subscribe button. However it is you listen to your pods, make sure you hit subscribe. And of course, you can give us a comment or you can follow us on Twitter, or now known as X, at Whitehall Pod UK.
Thank you.